Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. And today we're speaking with Mark Faber, publisher of the Gloom, Doom, Boom Report, best-selling author, and one of the world's best-known macroeconomic thinkers. Mark is a return guest on our podcast series. We spoke with him over a year ago, and we're delighted to catch up with him again now that so much has happened in the intervening time. Mark, it's a real pleasure to have you back as our guest.
It's my pleasure to be a guest.
Well, let's jump right in. What are the implications of the recent Greek default announcement? How does this inform your greater assessment of the macroeconomic picture?
Personally, I think that the Greek issue has been completely overplayed and misinterpreted. Say, the climax of the peak issue was in, say, October, November of last year, and everybody was very bearish, and what happened because of the bailout of Greece and so forth, the markets rallied very strongly. We're up more than 25% from the October 4th low when the S&P was at 1,074. So I think that the Greek issue is not market determining. In other words, the market focuses on other issues that are more important.
So the Greek issue, it's not a big issue because the amount's involved or because it's already been priced in, or why is it not an issue?
It's been priced in because, don't forget, from the March 6th lows at 1,000 and something on the S&P, 1,066, no, sorry, from the March lows, at 666 on the S&P, we went up to 1,370 on May 2nd, 2011. Then we dropped to 1,074 on October 4th, and then we rallied again. So the drop from 1,370 in May 2011 to the low in October of 1,074 already discounted the problems in Greece.
Okay, so I'm noticing that I'm not a huge believer in holding of stocks in general, equities at this point. I think you've noted that equities would be a good place to maybe survive or hide out from the coming inflation. So if we're looking to preserve our purchasing power against inflation in the future, and I want to get to some other data around that in just a minute. I'm interested in your rationale for being in the stock market at this particular point in time. You've also noted recently that you think that there's rough times coming ahead, that maybe equities are overbought. What's your general position on the stock market right now?
Well, basically, I mean, the stock market has rallied very significantly, and we're up more than 100% from the March 6, 2009 lows. So we're no longer oversold or undervalued. We're fairly valued if you take current earnings. But the problem is that maybe earnings are inflated and that earnings will decline. And so maybe the prospects for stocks are not particularly good. Equally, if you look at different asset classes, say you take real estate, equities, bonds, corporate bonds, government bonds, commodities. What is the best place to be in a disaster scenario? And in my view, probably by being in equities, you will not lose everything. You will lose maybe 30, 40%, who knows, in a disaster scenario. But in government bonds, you may lose everything because governments may default. So all I'm saying is the more bearish you are about the world, about social conditions, geopolitical conditions, the more actually you should be aiming at equities because companies usually survive. They survive with less earnings, but they survive. we as government, it's up to them to default. And so I'm not entirely out of the stock market, although I think that we may have a significant correction coming up in the next 3 months.
So with the possibility of a significant correction, let me widen out just a little bit further, though, into the larger macro view, because you note that sovereign debt has a chance of defaulting where you could actually get wiped out, Greece being an example of that.
Correct.
Maybe Portugal coming up next, Spain, Italy, someone. I'm looking here at a chart of 8 central bank balance sheets tracked from 2006 on.
Correct.
And I note that they collectively sum up to around $5.5 trillion in 2006, and that by the end of 2011, they total $15.5 trillion. So that's
correct.
$10 trillion of balance sheet expansion just those 5 years. So three questions. What will be the impact of all of that? Can those balance sheets ever be unwound without calamity ensuing? And is this behavior going to continue? So starting with that first question, what's your assessment of the impact of this $10 trillion over 5 years?
First of all, I do not believe that the central banks around the world will ever, and I repeat, ever reduce the balance sheets. They've gone the path of money printing, and once you choose that path, you're in it, and you have to print more money. So that will not happen. In other words, the reduction of the balance sheets of the central banks. So the price level will be higher than it was before the balance sheet expansion. Now, what is inflation? Inflation can manifest itself in wages, in consumer prices, in asset prices such as real estate, equities, commodities, and so forth, art and collectibles. Now, the problem is that all these asset prices don't increase at the same rate at the same time, but it's a symptom of monetary inflation. And I think that, say, if you look at commodities, they bottomed out in 1998 and were up substantially. They will not go back to the 1998 level. Will they go up in a straight line? I don't think so, because we have China and the Chinese economy slowing down and so forth and so on. So I think that we have to be very careful what assets we have to choose. But in general, I think that the purchasing power of money has diminished very significantly over the last 10, 20, 30 years and will continue to do so. So by being in cash and government bonds is not a protection against this depreciation in the value of money.
Oh, absolutely. So you think you answered all three of my questions at once, which is great. So to paraphrase here, balance sheets are never going to contract. That once we're on this path of printing, we're always on it.
Actually, in my view, they will expand.
They will expand. So that's the continued printing. So then let me paraphrase Irving Fisher. I think we're on a permanent plateau of printing.
I don't think we are on a permanent plateau of printing. But you understand, if you start to print, it has the biggest impact. Then you print more, it has a lesser impact, unless you increase the rate of money printing very significantly. And the third, money printing has even less impact. And the problem is, like the Fed, they printed money because they wanted to lift the housing market. The housing market is the only asset that didn't go up substantially. We have bottomed out in many markets, I concede that, but across the board, real estate has not been affected positively from money printing. But what has been affected positively from money printing is the price of silver, is the price of gold, and of equities that have more than doubled from the lows in 2009.
Well, this is a very important point. If it turns out that once you're on the path of printing, you stay on the path, and that it requires ever-increasing rates of printing
Correct.
In order to have a similar impact on things. With this $10 trillion of money printing, it is by far the largest sustained effort of money printing we've ever seen, and arguably the world economy is limping along. It's in recession in multiple zones at this point in time, so it's not working. And this fits in with your thesis, which we're just going to continue to see more and more and more printing. Obviously, this story has to end somehow. We can't just continue to increasingly print at a faster rate with no impact.
Yes, but Chris, that you say that it hasn't been working, in my opinion, is not entirely correct. Yeah. In the short run, it has been working to some extent in the sense that equity prices are up, and interest rates are down, and so companies can issue bonds at extremely low rates. But every money printing exercise in the world leads to unintended consequences at a later point. And this is the important issue to remember. We don't know yet for sure what the unintended consequences are. For sure, we know one unintended consequence, and this is that the middle class and the lower classes of society, say 50% of the U.S., has rather been hurt by the increase in the quantity of money, in the sense that commodity prices, in particular food and energy, have gone up very substantially. And since the below 50% of income recipients in the U.S. spend a lot, much larger portion of their income on food and energy than, to say, the 10% richest people in America and highest income earners. They have been hurt by monetary policy. In addition, say, the lower income groups, if they have savings, traditionally they keep them in, say, deposits and in cash, because they don't have much money to invest in the first place. So the increase in the value of the S&P hasn't helped them, but it's helped the 5 or 10% or 1% of the population that owns equities. So it's created a wider wealth inequality and that is, say, negative from a society point of view.
Oh, I completely agree. And there's been, of course, savers have been punished with this 0% interest rate environment, in particular pensions and other large, long-time horizon savers, as it were, are certainly also impacted.
And plus the pension fund industry, they have to have some returns. But when interest rates are at zero on cash deposits and on, say, long-term government bonds, on the 10-year note, say 2%, on 30 years, 3%, they cannot meet their liabilities. So their unfunded liabilities increase very substantially.
If you were in their shoes, what would you do right now?
In the shoes of whom?
Say a fiduciary of, say, a pension fund trustee or somebody like that.
Well, I mean, I think personally that over the last 20 years, the financial sector has not criticized the Federal Reserve sufficiently. They should have attacked the Federal Reserve for printing money left, right and center. But you understand, the financial service industry benefits from rising asset prices. Mm-hmm. So when you have a crisis, whether it's the SNL crisis or the tequila crisis in 94 or LTCM or the NASDAQ going down, they cheered that the Fed continued to print money because it lifted asset prices. And so their salaries went up and the performance fees went up and so forth and so on. So what I would do if I were the Fed chairman, having been completely wrong about really everything, but really everything, with his abstruse theories about the depression and the current condition, for sure I would resign. But if I were, say, a pension fund, I would tell the contributors and the recipients, either you pay more or you receive less. But we have to balance the books because the returns aren't going to be the ones that we are used to between 1982, when the Dow Jones bottomed out below 800 and subsequently rose to over 14,000. It's not going to happen again in real terms. Maybe if they print money. But if they print money, as I said, the purchasing power of the, say, average American household will diminish because his cost of living will increase that much more.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to just back up for 1 second and note that I should be more careful. You're right. The money printing has had effects, of course. And my point back there was just that money printing today is not having the impact it had in the past. $10 trillion dumped into the markets in 1990 would have been a very different circumstance than what we're seeing today. And we're seeing a lot of loss of traction today. I'm wondering, from my vantage point, I note that there's never been a global recovery with oil prices, even at an inflation-adjusted level, at the current levels they're at. Do you see these high energy prices, particularly for petroleum, are these a contributing factor in this loss of traction, or is this just because is the loss of traction simply we have too much debt in the system and that's the main factor here?
I think you're asking a very important question. Traditionally, oil prices around this level have been negative for economic growth around the world, whereby we have to distinguish. Say, in 1998, when oil prices bottomed out at $10 a barrel, the income from oil or the expenditures for oil were around $400 million. $400 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the current price, they are around $4 trillion. In other words, some people get the $4 trillion, the people that produce the oil, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Venezuela, Ecuador, Angola, Nigeria, and so forth. And on the other hand, the people that use the oil, the U.S. and Western Europe, they pay a higher price. So for some people, it's a revenue, and it's an expenditure. The people that have to spend it on, unless they can borrow more and more as they have in the past, they can roll it over. In other words, it's not damaging.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that can't borrow money to pay for the increased price in the oil, in other words, like an increased tax, they suffer. So they have less to spend. And that's why I think the economy in the Western world will be relatively sluggish. I think we've bottomed out in the U.S., but it will remain relatively sluggish. But mind you, say anything happens in the Middle East, and the price of oil goes from, say, the current level of $110 or $100 to $150 or $200, what do you think Uncle Ben will do? Uncle Ben, he knows only one thing, and this is to print money.
Indeed.
And so he will print money, and as a result of the money printing, the oil price may, following a crisis, go down somewhat, but it's not going to go down to $30. It will stabilize at, say, $100, and the economy will be sluggish. And so he will need to print more money. Because what else does he know? He knows nothing.
Well, and as you noted before, when he prints money, he hands it out and it goes sort of disequally across the society, with the printing very much not ending up in the lower middle class hands at all. So those rising oil prices are just going to continue to exacerbate. We'll have the wealth inequality issues. We'll have rising levels of food stamp usage. And the bottom really gets taken to the cleaners in this printing effort. And what I'm seeing here is this really large structural problem where originally we had too much debt, and now we might have too little oil, because the oil markets are actually pretty tight right now. And that's a structural, maybe a geological problem. And so you can't print oil, but we're going to do what we know how to do, which is print. So these two great forces are coming together, a historical tendency to print, which goes back, I believe, to Roman times in their own way of printing. But so we have this desire to print. That's how we get through these things. And then on the other hand, we have these rising oil prices, and that creates a structural imbalance. We're going to have more and more money going into the system, which brings me to a very important question, which is that you're a big proponent of holding precious metals, as am I. They've done quite well over the years. You've been advocating for them. They seem somewhat range-bound in recent months. Where do you see precious metals fitting into this story now and, say, for the rest of the year?
Well, I think that every person should own some precious metals as a reserve and as an insurance policy against a complete meltdown in the financial system. And as you know, we had MF Global. What did the clients get? Less than what they had in the company. And I think eventually the financial system will be an MF Global, where you don't get your money back from the banks and the investment banks and from the mutual funds and so forth and so on. And so I think everybody has to think himself, how do I protect myself against such a black swan event? Now, you have a life insurance policy and you have a health insurance policy. If you have a health insurance policy and a life insurance policy, you're not exactly hoping to die and have an accident. But if it happens, you have it. And so I would suggest that people own some precious metals. And I think, say, the prices, they've gone up a lot since the lows in 1998, 1999. But compared to the expansion of credit in the world, compared to the expansion of wealth in the world and money printing, I don't think that gold is terribly expensive. Having said that, I think we reached a peak at 1,921 on September 6th of last year. We made the low at 1,522 on December 29th of 2011. We rallied again. I think we're still in a correction period. But I'm not going to sell my gold when I see people like Obama running America. And possibly they'll have a Republican after 2013. But I don't think the Republicans will be much better. So I want to own some gold. And as I told you, I think the money printing will go on. Unless the Fed would come up and say, we're no longer going to print any money, the monetary base will remain steady. And even in that case, I wouldn't believe them.
Well, you mentioned something very important in there, which is MF Global. And I had a very instructive learning out of that. I actually got caught up in that. I had $50 in an account. So I'm actually part of the class action. That's a fun little fact there. I was keeping a placeholder account open at Lynn Waldock. But at any rate, what I saw in the MF Global situation was that people who had fully allocated numbered bars in their accounts at Comex had those taken as part of the trustee process, sold out and put into a general pool, and then they were distributed back, which is kind of like, to me, if it feels like you parked your car in a garage that went bankrupt and they seized your car, sold it, and gave you some money back for it. It just, that to me, that was a very instructive lesson that where you hold your gold seems to be incredibly important. So when you advocate holding gold, I assume it's not in a place like MF Global. How would you advocate people do that in the safest possible way, given our learnings from MF Global?
This is a very good question. Where is anything safe? I mean, I think in a safe deposit box, it's relatively safe, but maybe not in a safe deposit box in the U.S. Because if you look at the MF Global case, it seems, and I don't know for sure, but it seems that some people got their money. but not others. This is a very disturbing thing to happen in a financial system. And when I see this, I think we have to be very prudent. So I would hold, say, a safe deposit box outside the U.S. Now, the question is, how is it to hold a safe deposit box with a bank if the bank closes down and this and that? You can also hold safe deposit boxes in duty-free store warehouses at airports around the world. In Switzerland, we have them. In Singapore, we have them, and so forth. So that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and in part, you mentioned that this would be insurance against the possibility of a systemic crisis. We had, allegedly, we came within hours of a really bad meltdown in 2008 if Mervyn King and Hank Paulson, then Treasury Secretary, are to be believed. It was a pretty dire moment. I look at where we are today, and I notice that derivatives happen to be a little over $100 trillion higher than they were in 2008, and the imbalances at the sovereign debt level seem to have grown much larger. So I'm seeing that the basic, let's say, pressures on the system that were in play in 2008 all still seem to be in place, in fact, maybe larger in many cases. This systemic crisis you're talking about, would this be something like we had in 2008, where it was literally the potential meltdown of the banking system itself? Or are you thinking of something that would result in capital controls being imposed so that certain regions could be fireboxed off from other regions? What are you talking about when you use the term systemic crisis?
Well, I think that if you look at the history of crises in the last, say, 30 years, each one was greater and larger. And we had the NASDAQ going down, so they printed money and so forth. What did they produce? The housing bubble and an even worse crisis and so forth, and the financial crisis. And now they essentially didn't solve the problems, but they, say, alleviated the symptoms of the problems. And I think the next crisis will be much worse. But the question is, you know, as I said earlier, how do you protect yourself in the next crisis? Do you own equities, sovereign bonds, cash, commodities, gold, precious metals, and so forth? And my view is that you're probably better off in precious metals and in equities than in cash and in bonds. And I also happen to believe that in some parts of the U.S., notably the South, Phoenix, Atlanta, Las Vegas, and so forth, real estate prices are bottoming out. Now, can they drop another 10%? Yeah, sure. But another drop of 10% is not the end of the world when you consider that most individuals were in the NASDAQ in 2000 and then it dropped 70%. So I'm not saying that real estate will go up substantially. I'm just saying now you can buy real estate in the south of the U.S. at, say, 30 to 40% discount to the construction cost. So I think it's reasonably priced. I don't think it's... Yeah, actually, I think on global standard, it's relatively cheap. But my wider view is, you know, since 1982, we had a colossal asset inflation in equities, in real estate, and since 1998, also in commodities. One day, this asset inflation will come to an end the way the consumer price inflation in the 70s came to an end in, say, 1980, and thereafter we had this inflation. So it may be that the asset price inflation will not vanish altogether, but we may be in a period of disinflation. So if people are investing money, maybe they should adjust to the reality that the returns in future will not be 10, 20% per annum, but maybe only, say, 2% or 3% above the rate of inflation. And in terms of bonds and cash, it will be, say, 5% below the level of inflation.
Well, this is a fascinating point you made to start this out as well, which very important point here, which is that over the decades, each crisis has been larger than the prior one. That is, that the crises are growing in size. I'm wondering, to widen our lens up a lot, is that an indictment of an exponentially growing debt-based money system? Is it just a feature of the money system itself? Or is this an indictment of human tendencies, how we tend to operate that system, or both?
Well, you could build a conspiracy series. Basically, the U.S. had a significant increase in the average household income in real terms from the late 1940s to essentially the mid-1960s. And then inflation began to bite and real income growth slowed down. Then came the 1980s, and in order not to disappoint the household income recipients, you essentially printed money and had a huge debt expansion. So, if you have an economic system and you suddenly grow your debt at a very high rate, it's like an injection of a stimulant. Steroids. Mm-hmm. So the economy grew at a relatively fast pace, but built on additional debt. And this obviously cannot go on forever. It went on for much longer than I thought, because I started to write about excessive debt growth already in the late 80s. So I was very early about this. But when it comes to an end, you have a problem. So the Fed, that never paid any attention, the Fed is about the worst economic forecaster you can imagine. They are academics. They never go to a local pub. They never go shopping. They lie. But basically, they are a bunch of people who never worked a single day in their lives. They're not businessmen that have to balance the books, earn some money by selling goods, and pay the expenditure. They get paid by the government. And so these people have no clue about the economy. And so what happened is they never paid any attention to excessive credit growth. And let me remind you, between 2000 and 2007, credit growth was five times the growth of the economy in nominal terms. In other words, in order to create $1 of GDP, you had to borrow another $5 from the credit market. Now, this came to an end in 2008. Now, the Fed, that never paid any attention to credit growth, they realized if we have a credit-addicted economy, and credit growth slows down, we have to print money. So that's what they did. But believe me, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that if you print money, you don't create prosperity. Otherwise, every country would be unbelievably rich because every country would print money and be happy thereafter.
I think if it were possible to print your way to prosperity, we'd all be speaking Latin because the Romans would have figured it out. They were very clever people.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the Fed, in my view, is the dumbest institution because if they read history, they could figure out what money printing does. But they do it.
All right. So here we are in this path of printing, and I want to speak of these local impacts down at the pub where you get a sense of things. A lot of talk on my site about the inflation the U.S. is exporting to the rest of the world. You live in Asia. What are you seeing from your vantage point there?
Well, basically in Asia, we had a lot of inflation and much more than what the government published. I mean, prices are going up substantially and the economies are still doing reasonably well because we have a competitive advantage and we have domestic consumption growth, but basically there's a difference. I mean, everywhere I go in the world, there's one thing that strikes me. You go to a luxury hotel. There are Maseratis, Ferraris, Bentleys, Jaguars, and so forth in front of the hotel, and the ordinary people are struggling. I see that everywhere. And so I think that in Asia we have also imbalanced growth, and we have widening social division and rising social tensions. And I also think that the Chinese economy, which grew trend line between 2000 and 2007, then they printed money, had huge fiscal deficits and so forth, they are now in a significant slowdown period. I'm not talking about the stock market. Maybe the stock market goes up because of money printing. All I'm saying, the economy is slowing down very significantly, which will have implications on the global economy.
So, in summary, we have the idea that it's might want to sidestep equities for now. The next few months might be kind of interesting for equities, in part because earnings...
Well, I'm not sure. I think the market is overbought and that the correction is forthcoming. But, you know, who knows if there is enough money printing and markets are irrational at times and maybe they push them up more. But say the technical indicators have deteriorated. So I personally, when I was positive about equities in November, December, because sentiment was very negative, now I'm taking some money off the table.
Some money off the table. And the idea is to hold gold and silver as safely as you can, maybe in a nice warehouse in a airport district or something.
Yes, but also about gold and silver, I'm just telling people, you should buy it as an insurance.
Right.
It can go down 30%. We are in volatile markets, so, you know, you want to have your insurance safely. You don't want to leverage up in the futures market gold and it goes down 10% and you're wiped out because of margin calls. It's all a matter of degree, how much you allocate to each asset class.
Agreed. And so gold and silver as the core insurance policy at the center of a portfolio, that's the substance that will also never go to zero. At least 6,000 years of history suggests as much. So holding gold and silver...
Yeah, but the problem is it can be taken away from you.
Are you concerned about that?
Yes. You know, looking at the governments and the interventions into the economic system. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I tell everybody I grew up in the 50s and 60s. I think we had much more freedom than there is freedom today. And so this is a concern of mine. So, I mean, look, in my view, we are all doomed. But maybe if you keep your gold in a safe place, you're doomed later than other people who have no gold and only paper money and government bonds.
All right. And I like that view. So if we're all doomed in this way, though, you're really, this comes back to an indictment of the idea that our paper system itself, our paper money system, is doomed. Not, I mean, we saw this in the 30s where even our gold money system had failed us at a period of time. There were productive factories and people wanted to work and there were plenty of raw materials or resources. What failed was the money system. So money systems can fail even if it's a gold and silver money system, but now we have a fiat money system that's been running amok. Okay, well, I think we lost Mark there. I wanted to wish him well and congratulate him on just a wonderful interview. This has been a fabulous conversation that we've had. And to summarize, he's looking at equities as being overbought at the moment, potentially, but that equities are ultimately a way that you can be assured of sidestepping some of the larger issues that are out there, which are sovereign defaults. And obviously very bearish on sovereign debts at this point in time and correlated debts around that. You mentioned holding gold and silver as safely as he could, but I think a very important point that he made that I want to reiterate here is that from his vantage point, it's ordinary people everywhere that are suffering and that there are social and political tensions that are following along with that. So this money printing, which is obviously a worldwide phenomenon at this point, is impacting people disequally. So those obviously closer to the trough are doing quite well, and those further from the trough are doing less well, and that this is something that central banks have a tendency to both miss and promulgate at the same time. He's also noticing that there is a slowdown in the economy worldwide, and so these are all important points to consider. So, Mark, if you happen to listen to this interview, thank you very much. Truly appreciate your time.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.